Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, there's been a lot of discussion about who won or lost the September 26th presidential debate, but little discussion of how it served the voters. What was and wasn't talked about in a debate that focused largely on military issues at the expense of diplomacy? We'll talk to Phyllis Bennis, who directs the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project, about the debate. Also on the show, thousands of people may show up to the polls in November, only to be told they are not allowed to vote. A new report on voter purges says that what ought to be a simple updating of registration rolls can be a process that is shrouded in secrecy, prone to error, and vulnerable to manipulation. We'll hear from Wendy Weiser of the Brennan Center for Justice on what should be a story about your right to vote. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Determining who won a presidential debate depends largely on who you're asking. It's also been noted over the years that the people who get to pontificate after a debate can actually sway people's opinions about the event. So it was revealing to see the Washington Post feature on September 30th, which gathered reactions from foreign policy analysts and others to the first Obama-McCain debate. What was striking was how hawkish the Post circle of foreign policy experts is. The lineup included Henry Kissinger, inevitably, and an assortment of hawks from right-wing think tanks and or the Bush administration. Danielle Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Rubin, also from that group and from Donald Rumsfeld's Pentagon, Patrick Claussen and David Makovsky from the right-leaning Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Michael O'Hanlon of the centrist Brookings Institute also was tapped for his response. O'Hanlon is one of the most prominent Iraq hawks. Also representing Brookings in the Post was Pakistan expert Stephen P. Cohen, who used to work for the Reagan State Department. Those who aren't obvious hawks mostly have Republican connections. Michael J. Green of Center for Strategic and International Studies worked for George Bush. Karen Donfried of the German Marshall Fund was an aide to Condoleezza Rice. Nancy Soderbergh used to work for Bill Clinton and now advises Republican New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. And another Post expert was Ronald D. Asmus, a former Clinton aide, best known for his advocacy of NATO expansion. Rounding out the list was a change of pace of sorts, David Walker of the Peter Peterson Foundation. Walker's not a foreign policy hawk, he's a deficit hawk. That's about as close as the Post got to having an actual diversity of opinion.
More on that. The Sunday after that first debate, the New York Times ran a piece by Jim Rutenberg headlined, "The Next Day, a New Debate on Who Won." It described the McCain and Obama camp's attempts at, quote, influencing the public perception of who won an encounter that produced no clear winner or loser, close quote. What's really unclear is this story, though, which has trouble saying what it's about. It begins with reference to public perceptions. Well, attempts that were made to poll the public seemed to find that most felt Obama had won the debate. CNN's Friday night poll found 51% saying he'd done a better job versus 38% for McCain. In CBS's Friday poll of undecided voters, 40% called Obama the winner versus 22% for McCain. Rutenberg dismisses these polls, though, saying, quote, "Mr. Obama appeared to have an edge in the various snap polls taken the night of the debate, though these are notoriously unreliable," close quote. Okay, though media sure cite those polls a lot, considering their notorious unreliability. Ultimately, though, Rutenberg seems to be saying that public opinion really isn't up to the public. The story winds up focusing on how, quote, "campaigns go full bore to convince the news media and ultimately the public that their candidate won," close quote. This is based on what Rutenberg calls the common belief in presidential politics that, quote, "many viewers base their judgment not necessarily on debate performance, but on what they read and see in the days afterward," close quote. So I guess what he's ultimately saying is, when media want our opinion, they'll give it to us.
Economist Dean Baker recently provided an example of the Washington Post editorial page, the site of much scaremongering about Social Security, not so much distorting information to advance their argument as just, well, making it up. In a September 28th editorial, the Post warned readers that the coming budget crunch actually begins, quote, in 2011, when Social Security's cash flow turns negative, close quote. That, says Baker, is simply untrue. The Social Security Trustees report projects that income from designated Social Security taxes, not counting interest on its government bonds, will exceed benefits until 2017. The bigger point is that the fixation on that date is inappropriate, since Social Security is financed by a designated tax with a surplus that's been used over the last 25 years to acquire more than $2 trillion in government bonds. Those bonds can keep the program fully solvent until 2042, according to the trustees themselves, or until 2049, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Far more imminent shortfalls have been handled in the past. So where did the paper get the year 2011 as something to worry about? Baker suggests thin air. Of course, if the paper has a more substantive source, it'd be good to know what it is.
The New York Times offered a strong endorsement this week for New York City's billionaire mayor, Michael Bloomberg, in his call for city council to unilaterally reverse a voter-approved term limits law so he can seek a third term in office. The day before Bloomberg was slated to announce the proposal, a New York Times editorial declared that, quote, we would go further and ask the council to abolish term limits altogether, not to serve any individual's political career, but to serve the larger cause of democracy, close quote. The editorial added that, quote, the law is particularly unappealing now because it is structured in a way that would deny New Yorkers, at a time when the city's economy is under great stress, the right to decide for themselves whether an effective and popular mayor should stay in office, close quote. It's funny, though, about the Times and the idea that abolishing term limits, no matter the impact on any individual politician, serves the cause of democracy. Just last year, when it was Venezuelan voters considering a proposed reversal of term limits that would allow them to re-elect popular President Hugo Chavez, a New York Times editorial celebrated opposition, or as they put it, quote, hopeful signs that his plan to become president for life may be too blatant for the electorate to swallow, close quote. Writing about a Venezuelan referendum on a package of constitutional reforms, the Times complained specifically that as part of his latest lunge for power, Chavez was seeking, quote, the option to stand for re-election as many times as he wants, close quote. The paper concluded that, quote, opponents are calling for a massive no vote. For the sake of Venezuela's battered democracy, voters should heed the call, close quote. The upshot then, no term limits in Venezuela, outrageous lunge for power. No term limits in New York, serving the cause of democracy. Now try and keep that straight.
And finally, CNBC anchor Maria Bartiromo appeared on MSNBC's Hardball on September 30th, urging passage of the federal Wall Street bailout. You may not know this about her, but she really doesn't give a crap about Wall Street firms, despite a 15-year history of relentless touting. She only cares about the little people. As Bartiromo explained to Hardball host Chris Matthews, the bailout, quote, is about banks across the country being able to give the guy who needs a home loan a loan, give the gal who wants a car loan a loan, give the person who needs a home equity loan a loan. All that. That's all this is about, not about bailing out Wall Street firms, close quote. Well, that's right. It's all part of the corporate pundit class's enduring campaign of uplift for the little people. The same campaign that brought you such timeless hits as corporate taxes are bad because they're just passed along to the little people, and bailouts of the little people through welfare are bad because they make little people dependent, now has a new tune. Bailouts of billionaire firms are really bailouts of the little people, which are usually bad, but acceptable in this case.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
When PBS's Jim Lehrer, who moderated the only presidential debate dedicated to international policy on September 26, decided to focus virtually all of his questions on U.S. wars, as in Iraq and Afghanistan, and possible military actions, in, for instance, Iran and Pakistan, the narrow discussion that followed neglected important trading partners such as Canada and Mexico, allies, including France, Germany, and Britain, and emerging economic powers such as China and India. By treating international relations as military matters and avoiding any real discussion of diplomacy, the debate largely remained within the familiar confines of Bush-era militarism. To discuss what was and wasn't talked about at the debate and how that discussion fared in informing voters about the respective approaches John McCain and Barack Obama would take toward international relations, we have Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN, as well as Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. Welcome back to Counterspin, Phyllis Bennis.
Great to be with you.
Well, of course, war is very serious, deserving of wide discussion, and while this limited debate, which also included last-minute questions on emergent financial issues, may not even have devoted enough time to military matters, they were still its main focus. Considering that the point of these debates is to inform voters about the candidates' views, how do you think this debate did in that regard?
Well, I think it showed the degree to which there is not nearly the difference between the two candidates that I think most people think there is on specifically international issues. It, as you say, left out crucial questions, but it did reflect the reality of where political discourse is in this country in elite circles of both parties about how to think about the world, and that is the privileging of military involvement over diplomacy, the privileging of the Pentagon over the State Department in how political affairs in the rest of the world get dealt with. So in a sense, the problems with the questions that Jim Lehrer raised were very much a reflection of the problems of U.S. foreign policy today.
Well, within the confines of the debate that did happen, that largely focused on military issues and war, how did they do just in sussing out the differences there, do you think?
I think that particularly on the question of Iran, there was a bit of the nuance available for anyone who was looking for it to see the difference. Both McCain and Obama have made clear that the military option remains, as they put it, on the table. But there's a huge difference between the kind of gleeful militarism of John McCain, who, of course, famously answered the question about what he would do in Iran, and he kind of smirked and then sang, bomb, 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 Iran, as if he was, you know, a beach boy of the 1960s, whereas Obama had a far more serious call for engagement, for diplomacy, first, at least, although not, again, taking the military possibilities off the table altogether. What was more disheartening, I think, was seeing how close the two candidates are on the question of Iraq, where both will leave large numbers of troops on the ground for an indefinite period. Now, there's, again, a significant difference. Obama would withdraw half the troops. He calls that ending the war. I'm not sure that leaving behind up to 80,000 occupation troops really counts as ending the war, but that's the terms that are being used. On McCain's side, of course, his claim is the surge, adding additional troops, is all that has made Iraq a safer place today, and it's great, and we should keep them there indefinitely. So there were huge differences in tone, but both would keep large numbers of troops on the ground. Similarly, in Pakistan and Afghanistan, both are calling for significant escalation of U.S. involvement militarily in Afghanistan. And then Pakistan, of course, they're both talking about using military force regardless of the decision of the ostensibly democratic, ostensibly U.S. ally government in Islamabad.
Well, at one point during the debate, John McCain proposed the formation of what he called a League of Democracies, which may have sounded vaguely good, like something of at least a feint towards a diplomatic venture in the debate. But McCain's proposal really demanded but didn't get a follow-up question from Jim Lehrer. What do you know about McCain's League of Democracies?
This idea of a League of Democracies is an old neocon call. It's part of the widespread U.S. effort to undermine the United Nations. And what it basically says is the U.N. doesn't work because there's too many countries in there that we don't like. So what we're going to do is pull together a, quote, League of Democracies, defined as the countries we like. and designed to keep other countries at bay, undermine them, attack them, mobilize against them, unite against them, etc. It raises some extraordinary questions. What are the countries that would likely be among the 100 or so that McCain says would be in his league of democracies? Are you going to include a country, say, like Egypt, which has elections, but where one family, one man, has run the place for decades and who is grooming his son to take over? Are we going to include the officially non-democratic Arab states that are so close to the United States, like Jordan, a favorite of the U.S.? Is Jordan going to be considered a democracy because it has a parliament, even though its absolute monarchy is allowed to dissolve the parliament whenever it wants? And what's going to happen to all the countries in Latin America who are mobilizing very tightly these days against U.S. interests in trying to undermine their economies and their governments, and who are among the most democratic elections that have been held in recent years in the world? Will they count? Will Venezuela and Bolivia, for example, be allowed to be part of the U.S.-determined League of Democracies? So it raises some very interesting questions that go directly to the heart of what John McCain's real ideas are about multilateralism. This is not an effort to create new diplomacy or new multilateral approaches. This is something very specifically designed to undermine the United Nations.
Well, let's say that Phyllis Bennis was chosen to moderate a presidential debate on international relations. Put aside for a moment whether or not Western civilization would survive such an event. But what question would you pose to John McCain and Barack Obama?
Oh, that's a hard one. I think I would, if I had only one question in different language for each of them, but essentially the same question would be some version of, while you believe that these wars of choice that the U.S. has chosen in recent years are making us safer, people around the world not only believe but are acting on the belief that these wars are evidence not of a search for safety but of a search for domination. Regardless of whether you agree with them or not, how do you imagine being able to change that perception if you're not prepared to end the wars?
We've been speaking with Phyllis Bennis. She directs the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project. Phyllis Bennis, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Last week's Counterspin discussed the story of Michigan GOP officials' plan to use a list of foreclosed homes to challenge voters at the polls. The officials now deny that was a plan, but reporter Eartha Jane Meltzer reminded us that voter suppression efforts are really nothing new or exotic. There isn't always an open admission of an intentional effort to interfere with the process, but then there doesn't need to be. A variety of practices and policies can and do put unnecessary and sometimes illegal obstacles in the way of people's ability to exercise their critical right to vote. It ought to be a big story for national media, especially after concerns raised in the last two presidential elections. But is it being treated as seriously as it should be? Joining us to talk about some of the things interfering with your right to vote is Wendy Weiser. Wendy Weiser directs work on voting rights and elections at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. Welcome to Counterspin, Wendy Weiser.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the Brennan Center has just released a new report on one undercovered, in my view, practice that can have serious impact on voting, and that's voter purges. Can you explain what voter purges are, and are they a bad idea or are they a good idea that's done badly?
Well, voter purges is simply the act of removing the names of voters from the voter rolls. It's typically supposed to be people who are ineligible, who have moved, who have died, and who shouldn't be on the voter rolls. And so as a practice, it's something that should be done and should be done to keep our lists up to date and accurate. But we have studied the practice in a number of states across the country and found that it's actually done quite poorly across the country through a process that is quite secret, prone to serious error, and even vulnerable to manipulation.
Now, you note that you have real examples. This isn't just theory. Some of the concrete examples, what was the impact?
Over the past couple of years, there have been a number of purges that have come to light, and unfortunately, we don't learn of all of them because they are done in secret and because there isn't enough public scrutiny of them. But every time a purge comes to public light, we find that there are lots of eligible voters that are caught up, and sometimes the purge seems to be discriminatory or otherwise really problematic. This year, for example, in Mississippi, an election official from her home actually deleted 10,000 names from her home computer as a purge. So we have a really ad hoc procedures in place without any controls and without any way of preventing these kinds of improper purges from happening. Fortunately, another election official caught this, and this was able to be reversed. But this kind of stuff is happening around the country.
What about folks who aren't on the list in the first place? I know you have concerns about maybe not purges, but things that affect the rolls even before the purge.
We've been seeing a lot of new barriers for voters getting access to the voter rolls over the past couple of years. One related barrier is in a number of states, we're seeing election officials refusing to let voters on the rolls if they can't pass a computer match, if they can't match their voter registration records against driver's license or Social Security records. But the process they use actually miss 20% of the time. So if you're not letting voters on, if they don't pass this match test, then you're going to lose 20% of new registrants that should be getting on the rolls. And we're seeing this problem in Florida. There are efforts in Wisconsin right now to try and push this through right before the 2008 election. And where really hundreds of thousands of people might be affected if that happened.
Well, it seems to me that the time to talk about problems with the voting process is really in advance of an election when something might be done about them, particularly if there are real policy changes being called for. I'm a little bit galled to see stories now headlined, "Will your vote count?" in November. But then media's window of interest tends to confine election stories to election season. What is your assessment generally of media attention to the voting rights issues that you work on?
You're absolutely right that there's a real problem with covering the issues too late to do anything about it. And this is a problem that we've seen over the past couple of elections. You know, if there are serious problems in an election, sometimes you see the coverage happen after an election, which does give time to try and fix the problems that happened in that election. In this election season, we've actually been quite pleased, even though the coverage has come a little bit late. It hasn't been too late to make a lot of the changes, and there's been a much higher interest in these kinds of voting problems that we've been seeing over the past several federal elections. There's been a real increase in efforts to put barriers in front of voters, and there's been insufficient media scrutiny to really hold election officials accountable, to hold political party operatives accountable, to make sure that voters aren't being unfairly knocked out. And we're really finally seeing it go over the hump and a lot of attention being paid to these issues. So we hope that that will create a really good opportunity for reform. Americans don't want to see this kind of shenanigans in their elections.
Well, and we have seen in terms of the coverage an unfortunate tendency in the past, which I would like to see changing. There's reporters tending to balance Republican claims of vote fraud on the part of Democrats, even when those stories tended not to pan out, and sort of balancing them was against claims of voter suppression on the part of Republicans, to the point where it became just a story of kind of tactical allegations, one party against the other, rather than there being a set of answerable questions about the sanctity of the voting process. You're saying the coverage is a little bit more focused on what's actually going on this time around, you think?
Yeah, I think that that's our observation. The voter fraud story was shown to be not overblown, but was really discredited after the U.S. Attorney scandal and the Department of Justice scandal, where it was shown that this story was being put out there as an attempt to manipulate the electoral process, to use the Department of Justice improperly. And so that has played less of a role in recent coverage since, you know, there have been a lot of investigating demonstrating that the kind of voter fraud that was being complained of, you know, individual voters showing up at the polls and trying to pretend to be other people, was something that just wasn't happening, that there was absolutely no evidence of, that detailed DOJ investigations turned up nothing. So that is not figuring prominently right now in the coverage.
So that red herring isn't there this time around. Well, I did see that CBS Evening News did a segment on the Brennan Center's new report on voter purges. Unfortunately, it followed Katie Couric's interview with Sarah Palin, so some people may have been too stunned to pay attention to it. But are you looking for, has there been a generally welcoming response from the press when you put out these reports? It's not just folks like us, but the big media do take an interest.
Yeah, and there's really an increasing interest in taking a look at the problems with our voting process. I think there's an increasing recognition that there's a lot of room for error and manipulation, that we haven't been paying sufficient attention, that we haven't been putting protections in place, and that there's a lot of politics with the rules of the game, that, you know, each side is, you know, has the ability to try and manipulate the rules of the game to try to knock out the other side's voters. And that's not the way an election system should be run.
Well, if you were making assignments for reporters and they just needed a few story ideas, purges would be one, definitely. Are there other aspects of the electoral process that you would say, hey, there's a story to investigate there, to look into?
I mean, there are certainly a lot of stories to be told. There has really been insufficient investigation, and I think you're absolutely right that the purge process is an area that's really ripe for investigation. This is done behind closed doors. Every time it comes to light, problems are revealed, and if they're revealed early enough, they can be corrected. So this is something that reporters can really make a big difference in. It is not the only practice. You were talking about caging practices or other challenges to voters' eligibility at the polls. If that's investigated and brought to light before an election, then discriminatory challenge efforts or really just disruptive efforts that will really hold up voting at the polls and really knock out a bunch of eligible voters, you know, can be stopped beforehand through public scrutiny.
We've been speaking with Wendy Weiser, Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. You can find their new report on voter purges along with other of their work on their website, brennancenter.org. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you again.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Bill Seary at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.